now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello everyone and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from classic cults and all the cheese in between. The movies are babe, the entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Jason Jackanay, and I'm back, this time with a movie. This time, the movie's from 1998. It's a little disturbing behavior, and I'll get to it right after this.
Welcome to Colonel Bay High, Stevie boy. Welcome to my nightmare. The owner runs with that group over there. Yeah. Blue Ribbons.
What's that?
It's a community group. Good kids have bake sales, car washes, kiss a lot of adults, speak to
blue robots.
Hear, hear. No, it's not bullshit. It's not steroids.
Here we go.
What?
Gavin thinks some sinister force is taking over the Cradle Bay meatheads.
Nah, you know what it is. You know.
A sinister force?
You know, evil. No way to turn, no one to trust, altogether ooky.
You signed me up for the program.
What's best for you?
What about what I want?
People are gonna know when I get out of here.
That's right, Stephen. They will know. They'll know because you'll be better.
Straight A's in a leather jacket. Every now and then you rape and kill.
Cure cancer, you gotta kill a few white mice.
Musical little creatures that hide among the flowers. You feel better, freer. Never felt so alive in my life.
That's what I didn't get. It'll be different. But I know so much more now. Adolescence is a minefield. Be fully equipped to walk right through it.
Disturbing Behavior was released July 24th, 1998, with an 84-minute running time. Okay, so that's going to come up again. The running time and what's in this movie and not in this movie is going to come up again. Anyway, your director is David Nutter. He's received in 2015 a Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Directing of a Dramatic Series for his work on Game of Thrones. You would know him from things like The X-Files, and he would go on to direct the pilot and help creation of Space Above and Beyond, Millennium, Sleepwalkers, Roswell, Dark Angel, Smallville, right? A lot of TV stuff. He also directed The Replacements, the four-part miniseries Band of Brothers, and shared the series. And he was obviously, you know, like I said, he was part of the, he also did the parts 2 and 8 of the Pacific miniseries. A lot of TV stuff you might know him from. Your writer is Scott Rosenberg. Scott Rosenberg is known as a writer and a producer. You might have seen him before, obviously. He's on Disturbing Behavior, where he's also co-producer. He also wrote Con Air, the Nicolas Cage movie. Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, which is, I think, it's one of those neo-noirs that a lot of people don't know about. He would also go on to be he would do the adaptation of High Fidelity. He was a writer on Gone in 60 Seconds. You know, I mean, he's probably super proud of Kangaroo Jack, but, you know, I've never been one. He also did Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, Venom, Jumanji the Next Level, and he's also tagged with Jumanji Open World. He has uncredited revisions done to Armageddon, The General's Daughter, so a whole bunch of stuff that you've heard of. The producing team is Armory Bernstein and Joel Shestack. Now, your stars here, James Marsden, yes, Cyclops is your main star here. And then you have Kate Holmes. Now, Katie Holmes. Katie Holmes, you would know as Joey on Dawson's Creek. Nick Stahl in a very early role here for him. Bruce Greenwood, William Sadler. William Sadler, some of you might remember as Death from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and, you know, people who actually know other things, but know him from, like, Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile and The Mist and the millions of other things this guy has been in, including Biloxi Blues. You know, so, like I said, music, Mark Snow, but this movie is not really, again, it's the music in the movie that it's known for is more of its soundtrack. This was part of the whole big push that the soundtracks had to be, you know, they would get songs on there, new bands, and it became like the soundtracks became like so much more than soundtracks had been back in the 80s, especially. And in the early 90s, you started seeing things coming out where they would have like movie singles, which is not a great film at all, but has a killer soundtrack, you know, kind of thing. This awesome grunge bands from Seattle in there and stuff like that. And that's I think the soundtrack's probably better than the movie, but you know, people don't have to agree with me. That's fine. I'm sure someone's favorite movie is singles. MGM, distributed in North America, Columbia TriStar Film Distribution internationally. Like I said, so $15 million budget, box office about $17.5 million. Now, I said it had an 84-minute running time, and it does. The version that you've probably seen, it had an 84-minute running time. There is no official director's cut out there. I'm just saying that now. There is no official director's cut out there. Is there a director's cut that some fans have kind of sewn back together? I want to say yes, because this movie was supposed to run about 114 minutes, and it ran 84. So let that sink in. About 30 minutes were cut out of this movie. And when we get to it, we're going to talk about the ending. And the original ending, which you can see on the Blu-ray, is not the ending that we got in the film. And we'll talk about why that is in a second. Anyway, this movie has drawn comparisons to the 1975 film The Stepford Wives and obviously the book. A lot of people, when this movie came out, I think, wrote it off immediately as just being in that post-Scream teen horror movie kind of thing. This movie is very different than Scream. Let's just call a spade. If you listen to when we talk about Scream on the Vault, I've already said all these things. Scream changed the game. Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson and everyone involved in Scream, it's a lot of Wes Craven, changed the game again. A lot like how Carpenter changed the game with Halloween, Wes Craven changed the game in the 90s with Scream. And we are now still living in that post-Scream world. Now we have Scream 7 and possibly a Scream 8. I can't wait for Scream in Space, where no one can hear you scream. You know, though things changed, and a lot of movies that might have been on the fringes of getting made and whatever, if we can tweak it and make it this teenage movie where it's like Scream, then we can get it made. And I think Disturbing Behavior got saddled in with that, even though Disturbing Behavior really is not a movie like Scream. The Faculty is another movie that kind of got... The Faculty is another movie that I want to talk about here, obviously, but because it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Shh, don't tell anybody. But, like, it's another one of those. There's a whole bunch of movies that came out that you could see the fingerprints of Scream getting put into it, because studios were like, hey, teens want movies like this. They want them under 90 minutes. They want to, like, they had these ideas that, like, every movie for a teenager had to be under 90 minutes. That's why this movie was cut so much. They had these other ideas that every cover had to be a black background with actors on it and all that. Like, they kind of just got in the idea of just mimic, not the movie Mimic, but like mimicking what they saw and trying to keep, you know, regurgitating back out the same thing, which we're still stuck in that now. I mean, it's just, you know, the old, everything is new, everything that is old is new again, except that there's nothing new. Anyway, let's get rock and rolling on the story. High school senior Steve Clark and is new to Cradle Bay. Oh, I just want to mention real quick, and then we'll talk about it in a second. When I get to his sister, I got to remember to mention who his sister is, because it's a very young version of somebody who later on you all, if you're horror fans, will love. Anyway, high school senior Steve Clark is new to Cradle Bay, a picturesque island community in Washington State's Puget Sound. His family's moved to Chicago after the suicide of his eldest brother, Alan, a loss Steve struggles with. Now, the whole thing is there's like nightmares and stuff he's having, but there's a whole section of about Alan and about his suicide and all this stuff that was all cut. Just all cut out. I mean, I think it changes the whole movie if you put that stuff back in, but be as it may. Where are we here? The loss Steve still struggles with. On his first day of school, he befriends three outcast students. Gavin, who is played by Nick Stahl. UV, who is Pigment Challenge. I don't know if we're allowed to say the A word anymore. Okay. If I get in trouble, fine. He's an albino. Sorry. That's what we call them. I had friends who were like, I had a friend like that growing up like that. So anyway, and then of course, Rachel Wagner, who is played by the one and only Katie Holmes. He also meets the school psychologist, Dr. Edgar Caldicott, who suggests he joins the Blue Ribbon program and a motivational workshop. The Blue Ribbons, a clique of preppy, clean-cut overachievers, attempt to recruit Steven, but Gavin steers him away, claiming that they are a murderous cult that has been brainwashed and lobotomized by Caldicott. Now, the movie opens with a member of the Blue Ribbons parked, notice the quotation of that, with a girl who proceeded to want to, as he said, steal his fluids. This show is family friendly, so that's how we're going to say that. But yes, that's how he says it there too. And then he proceeds to, as she's trying to steal his fluids, he breaks her neck, and she now is dead. And then the cops show up, and then he winds up killing a cop because why not? Because we're a minute in, we already have a scene between a young man and a young woman that ends in her death, and then a cop is killed because the 90s. But yes, so then that's when it leads into Steve and all them showing up. Anyway, here we go. Steve is skeptical of the theory, but keeps his distance from the blue, from the ribbons. Okay. Outside a grocery store, Rachel is approached by Chug, a blue ribbon who is who's attracted to her. When he catches sight of Rachel in her midriff bearing outfit, he flies into a rage and savagely beats up two men inside the store. Chug nearly kills him while the town's police chief, Officer Cox, simply looks on. When Steve asks what just happened and deduces that it must be roid rage, that's what Rachel deduces, Gavin again insists on his mind control theory, producing photos of former burnout friends who are now reprogrammed into blue ribbons. The blue ribbons also hang out at the yogurt shop in town. Gavin takes Steve to school hideout where they eavesdrop on parents meeting about hosted by Caldecott. After Gavin hears his parents sign him up for the Blue Ribbon program, he shows Steve a gun and he plans to use it as a potential brainwasher. Steve calls and paranoid, wrestles the gun away from him. The next day, Gavin shows up at school with a totally transformed look and an attitude befitting the Blue Ribbons. Okay, so a lot of this, and it's funny because a lot of people, I would say Stepford Wives is probably the best parallel to this. Although there are, like Dead and Buried has it there too, but Dead and Buried, they're dead and he just brings it back. But that would fit too, I think. The idea is that they're just being reprogrammed. Some people have tried to say that, like, oh, it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers again. I don't think so, because we're not talking aliens here. We're talking about a mad scientist, and we're talking about him, you know, reprogramming the youth. Whereas Invasion of Body Snatchers, they want to take over everybody. They just want to take over everything. But I digress. Steve tries to reach Gavin, but the other Blue Ribbons stop him. He's beaten up by the clique, and with Gavin landing the final blow, which is a knee to the gut. The one thing I can tell you about this movie, a lot of people get punched in the gut and punched in the face, and they punch, and nobody's hand hurts after they do this. I have not been in a fight in a long time, but I'm going to tell you right now, if you punch someone square in the face, just really hit them, no glove or nothing, it gonna hurt your hand. Anyway, I digress. At home, Steve finds the Blue Ribbon member, Lorna. Now, this is the scene that's going to happen here is literally the scene from the trailer that everyone remembers. The member Lorna in his living room, having just tutored his younger sister, Lindsay. And that's who I wanted to talk about. Who is Lindsay? Catherine Isabel! Yay! We love Catherine Isabel. If you're a horror fan and you don't know who she is, then I don't know if you're really a horror fan. I mean, Ginger Snaps, American Mary, Jason vs. Freddy, where she gets killed. She's in a lot of horror stuff. And Catherine Isabel is really young here. This is 1998, so she's even younger. Good God, I'm trying to think. Yeah, I mean, it's a few years away from even, because it was 98, so this had to be shot in like 97-ish. So she's a few years away from even being in Ginger Snaps, and she's pretty young there. Anyway, Lorna attempts to seduce him. She opens her shirt and stuff. But in her arousal, she flies into a violent rage. Repeating the words, wrong, bad, she smashes her face into the wall mirror, causing the break, and then grabs a shard and tries to stab Steve. Now, that is the scene. Every one of the trailers, the scene you see, you know, you don't see, obviously, you know, her, like, you kind of can't tell her shirt's all open, but her smashing her head into the mirror was in every single trailer for Disturbing Behavior. Every trailer had that in it, because it's enough for people to remember, and they're hoping that teens are like, whoa, okay, like, what's going on, you know? I don't know. We didn't talk like that back in the day, but it's what it is. Anyway, because I was, you know, 98, so I'm like a sophomore in college. What am I, like, you know, I'm 20-ish, right, kind of thing. So, yeah, because I just finished up high school. So these are all basically, you know, 20-year-olds playing high schoolers anyway. So about the same age. Anyway, where were we? Steve subdues her. She snaps out of her episode, blood running down her head. She goes, I have a big physics test tomorrow. Runs off, because nothing is scarier than a physics test. So I think it's the next day. Rachel is cornered in the school boiler room by Chug when a device that is used to repel rats by emitting a soft, high-pitched sound goes off, sending Chug into a frenzy. Rachel escapes as Chug finds a device and destroys it. The instance is whispered by Mr. Newberry, and that is the aforementioned William Sadler, who is pretending. Okay, he's pretending to be slow. He's pretending to be just not super bright. He's catching rats, and he's, you know, selling the rats to, you know, the carpenters of town for a quarter per rat. And he's just not supposed to be anybody who's got any brains. And obviously he does, because that's the whole point of this, is that he's kind of like pretending he's dumb so people kind of overlook him. Anyway, a janitor who, so he's not, and he's friends with Steve. Steve and Rachel venture to the mental hospital in search of answers, because that's where Caldecott had come from. They learn Gavin was right. Caldecott is implanting brain microchips into teenagers. with the approval of their parents, who want to reprogram their children from juvenile delinquents into well-behaved, model citizens. However, Caldecott cannot turn off the teenage hormones, resulting in violent fits whenever the subjects their sexually urges act up. They go into a fit of rage. Steve and Rachel return home to get Lindsay, but are ambushed by Caldecott and Steve's parents, who reveal their intention to sign Steve up for the program. Yes, when we're there, we learn that Caldecott has a daughter that he originally failed in trying to heal. The insane asylum, mental hospital, we should call it what kind of thing, is... Okay, I've never been to one, but I'm assuming you don't have all the patients just kind of milling about, but it works well for the movie. Is that Reanimator when you're kind of all just kind of walking around in there too? Anyway, where are we here? So Steve and Rachel are incapacitated and wake up in the program where they're going to be reprogrammed. But before they can, Steve, who had grabbed a scalpel as he was fighting them in there, cuts his way free, injures the technician. Actually, he doesn't stab the technician with the scalpel. He stabs him with the pad that's attached to his arm, the post that's coming out of that. That's what he stabs him with. But yeah. So anyway, whatever here. Sorry. Oh, and he finds Rachel and saves her on their way out. They encounter Chug, but Rachel strikes him and kills him with a UV pipe. Now, I'm going to say this. Chug does try to choke Steve with the cord on a payphone. Kids nowadays would be like, what? Huh? How is he choking with a cord? You mean his plug to plug in his phone? No, the metal cord on the payphone. What, he's choking him with it. And I'm like, man, the 90s. But that's such an old school kind of thing. Like, you know, having seen somebody try to strike somebody else with a phone receiver, you can understand how much that would hurt. Well, it happened, Jay. What if I threw my iPhone and hit you in the head? I'd rather get hit with your iPhone than an actual, like, real, especially a payphone receiver. Oh, my God. That would do so much damage. Anyway, UV and Lindsay arrive with a truck, and the group rushes off to catch the outgoing ferry. But they run into a roadblock where Caldecott and the Blue Ribbons are assembled. Newberry drives in his car, activating multiple rat-catching devices with all that noise, strapped the vehicle, and scrambling the minds of all the Blue Ribbons, who then chase him down the embankment and off, whatever. Steve sends UV, Lindsay, and Rachel to the ferry while he grabs the dirt bike and chases after Newberry. Newberry has been shot during this. Caldecott was shooting at him, shot him through the windshield, but it's okay. He hit Caldecott with the back of his car, which is awesome. So he knows he's dead. He's got all the kids on the back. And again, another brick in the wall, big in this movie. It's in the trailers and everything, right? Newberry drives off the cliff with all the kids hanging on, killing them all, after defeat. So then Caldecott shows up, with confronting Steve. Steve then kicks him off the cliff too. And Steve rejoins his friends, and the four teenagers leave Cradle Bay to begin their new life. So then we have our last scene. Now, I'm going to talk about, because that's the ending, and there's a different ending, and this is how the ending got changed. A class of unnamed high school students are acting rowdy, playing music. This is clearly supposed to be inner city. I'm not saying it's Chicago, but a kid's wearing a Chicago Bulls jersey. So again, Chicago ties into it. Obviously, that's where Steve and his family are from. But I'm not saying that this is supposed to be Chicago again, but it's definitely inner city. There's, African-American and Hispanic and, like, you know, whatever, you know, kids in the room, where the new student teacher walks in, revealing himself to be the still alive Gavin, who is still programmed with Blue Ribbon technology. Okay. So I keep kind of mentioning that there was a lot of cuts. There was. So originally, this was 114 minutes. They did a test screening. It didn't go well. So David Nutter went back in and he cuts pieces here and there, kind of trimmed things up. And then they retested and it still didn't go well. And the audience really didn't like the original ending. The original ending was Gavin also got on the ferry with a shotgun, and he was going to kill, obviously, the four. What winds up happening is that Gavin acts like he's going to let them go, turns and goes to pull the shotgun, and he's going to shoot them, and UV shoots Gavin 3 times, killing him. And that's how the movie's supposed to end. Yeah, I could see that being a bummer, but I'll be honest with you, Gavin getting shot was totally fine with me. You know, nothing against Nick Stahl personally, but the idea, the whole idea is that there was no saving them. Like, that's one of the big things. There's no way to save them. There's no way to unprogram them. There's no way to take the chips out. That's the problem. So what happens is now, they're setting it up for a sequel that was never going to happen, because this movie didn't make any weird money. I mean, it would have had to make like in the hundredth of thousands of dollars to get a sequel for this, because it's just, there's nowhere else to go with this story, at least not involving Steve, Lindsay, and UV. And I'm not sure, again, nothing personal to Nick Stahl, but I'm not sure that the Gavin character could carry a whole sequel. I could be wrong. I mean, you know, I'm not infallible, but I just don't think so. Anyway, though, what you now get is this truncated ending, and the studio came in, and 31 minutes had been cut from the whole movie. 31 minutes had been cut from the movie, cutting out whole scenes, cutting out a love scene between Rachel and Steve. I mean, you kind of tell they like each other, but there's nothing there on screen. There's very little. He kisses her at the end, but that's about it. There's nothing really there. And if someone thought that maybe, you know, teenagers don't want to see a sex scene in a movie, I'm not sure if they've met a teenager before, because that's what they want to see. I.e. see the 1980s and how slasher movies were made. So how to describe disturbing behavior? Is it a good movie in that it's memorable? Not really. I remember the scene of her slamming her skull into there. I remember the song. And when I watched it, I got the new cleaned up Blu-ray. It looks good. I mean, it's nothing wrong with it. It's just not memorable. It's certainly not as memorable as, in a post-Scream world, I don't know what kind of movies are memorable. I mean, it's not bad, and it's certainly not boring. It's enjoyable. You get kind of frustrated sometimes with character choices and stuff like that. But the idea is that you can enjoy the film as it is. Now, I'm not saying that I would have, Disturbing Behavior is not a movie I'm going to run out and watch. I probably haven't seen this movie since the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, I don't think it's ever on TV. I don't remember ever really seeing it. But when I watched the In Search of Darkness 95 to 99, they brought it up again. I was like, oh man, I remember Disturbing Behavior. And I was like, I should give that a watch for the show. Because I'm betting some of you saw it. I know any of us who were kind of in in the high school in the mid to late 90s and early in college in that time, this is the kind of movie that they show. I remember UA putting this on the movie station. So we used to have two movie stations, two channels that all they did was show movies. And they would just show movies, but they would rotate when they were on. And clearly it was like basically someone just took, VHS, we didn't have DVDs really at the time. DVDs were coming in, but had the movies and they would just kind of show them. So you know, that like on Monday, God dang, excuse me guys, sorry. On Monday, like you would get Disturbing Behavior be on at 8 o'clock in the morning and at like 8 o'clock at night. And then there'd be other movies on at like 11 and 11. Like it was always, and then the next day it would cycle. So when there was a movie on during the week that you wanted to see, you kind of, because they put the thing up, you're like, oh, what's coming out? Oh, this movie's going to be on. Let's watch it. And it became a thing. I cannot tell you, because again, we didn't have cell phones back then, guys. And the internet was attached to a computer that was like attached to the wall. Maybe you had a laptop, but your laptop wasn't going anywhere. It was not unheard of for us to, throw on the movie we'd already seen, a movie we enjoyed, especially when they would show horror movies at the Halloween time. Oh my God, they would show so many horror movies. You throw on a movie you enjoy, or even something you, whatever, and you just have dinner and watch it and hang out. Like many a night, I just kind of hung out in my room after practice, kind of thing, waiting to talk to Kelly, because she had, she was in college too, but we didn't go to college together. Waiting to talk to her, hopping online, on Instant Messenger and stuff like that. Wow, I'm really dating myself here. But you would do those things. I remember watching many movies like that, just part of a movie or whatever. And it was like, you say like, oh, you watched a lot of TV in college. You must have been a nerd. Well, I had track practice every day. So, yeah, I was kind of busy. And then when I got older, I'm in grad school and stuff, I was doing, shockingly, teaching and grad work. So yeah, I didn't go and party and stuff, but I wasn't that guy anyway. But you know, so I remember seeing disturbing behavior probably, you know, two or three times, you know, when it first debuted on there, and they were kind of rolling back out. But it's a movie that I think a lot of people have forgotten about. And I also truly, honestly believe a lot of people have conflated this movie and The Faculty into one movie. The Faculty, which is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's Claire Duvall and Josh Harnett and Robert Patrick. And like, that's the one, the high school with and Usher. Can't forget the Usher, right? Kind of thing. So I think sometimes they get conflated together, mainly because this is disturbing behavior. It does not stand out from the crowd. I don't think it wanted to. I'm thinking of movies. There's a lot of movies that came out in this time, Soul Survivor, and like, I'm drawing a blank on some of those names, that really kind of felt like the same things. And I think what Nutter was going for here, I think he was really going for an X-Files episode. He was going for, like, you know, something more gritty, something, you know, down and dirty kind of thing, and not just teen. I mean, they made him go back and reshoot scenes, for crying out loud, that he had to change things around. And it's like, man, I understand the studio definitely wants to make their money. I'm not saying the studio doesn't want to make their money, but it's just like, really? Like, what would have been so horrible about having a story that actually might not be cookie cuttered out of something else? And because you're taking the Stepford Wives idea, but then you kind of like neuter it and you change it, which is great. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't want you doing the exact same thing, but it just seems like, I don't know, you could have maybe not messed with it as much. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure, guys. I mean, I definitely feel the movie is lean at 84 minutes. Could it feel really bloated at 114? Maybe. I don't know. I've never seen the full cut. There is no full cut. I've watched the deleted scenes, but you're watching scenes. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not in the flow of the movie. So it's sometimes hard to tell how it would work. Anyway, do you remember Disturbing Behavior? Do you remember Another Brick in the Wall? Do you remember the chick slamming her skull into the mirror? That's literally how every trailer would have ended with it. Do you remember that stuff? Yes or no? I mean, I don't know, man. Hey, you know, if you do, write in. I'd love to hear from you guys. You know, let me know what you think. And have you I know I haven't officially talked about it here. I mention it all the time. The In Search of Darkness, 95 to 99, with the latest one, which I they put on their website. My wife watched the whole thing with me and was not bored and really enjoyed it. That's the biggest... I said something along those lines. I go, that's the biggest positive review I can give to anything ever. If my wife literally watched it and enjoyed it, and she doesn't like horror movies, that's the most ringing endorsement I can give you. I gotta admit though, the 90 to 94, again, wow, good. That's that weird time when you're coming out of the 80s into the 90s. There's weird stuff. That's when Freaked came out and stuff. I love Freaked. But 95 to 99, that's, you know, it's, you got Scream, you got Blair Witch, you got From Dusk Till Dawn, you got so many good movies in there, that still to this day hold up. But I think the late 90s was such a change, right? That was really when things turned over from that, you know, remember like some of you, and I say this because some of you might remember when you went from like the 70s into the early 80s and there was that crossover period, then the 80s finally took hold and you're like, man, the 80s, and it's gonna go, and then like into the early 90s, like the 1980s kind of lasted like almost to 1992, you know, kind of thing. It kind of was like, hey, it's still there, you know, kind of thing. And then the 90s started kind of morphing and grunge music and whatever kind of thing, and then we kind of got the 90s, which I know a lot of people consider to be a lost decade, you know, but it's when a good number of us cut our teeth on like the movies we like and the music we listen to. I still listen to music from then too. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love my 80s music. I love my 80s music. But you know, 90s grunge, I mean, you know, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, you know, like just that stuff, you know, kind of thing. And I think music was a big part of that in the 90s, especially as movies started kind of incorporating it. I mean, people will argue with this with me, but I think no other movie truly incorporated the music the way The Crow did. And The Crow soundtrack is still so good. And it is loaded with bangers. And it's got top flight artists on there and stuff. But this isn't The Crow podcast. This is Bots, Bugs, and Babes. And we are talking about Disturbing Behavior. You guys remember it? You know, do you have thoughts? Do you have anything? Love to hear from you guys. So I just want to thank everyone for all the support and love. As you know, it's just me rambling on here. Now what, 35 minutes or so, about a movie that you might not have ever seen or maybe saw one time in 1998 on a date and then you never thought about it ever again. But yeah, if you check it out, let me know, if you, you know, decide to go back and check it out and see what Cyclops was doing before he was Cyclopsing his way in with the X-Men anyway. So thank you folks again for all the love. Thank you all the downloads and listens. Keep that, keeping, you know, us here going again, a labor of love. None of us are making any money at this. We're just doing this. We love talking to you guys. So like we say here, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?